May I please declare, my name is Chris Forsyth, registration 22608, pro se in the case of my client, Patrick Youngs. Colorado's workers' compensation hearing and appeal process violates equal protection of the laws. The fundamental right for a fair and impartial hearing comes from the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. All litigants in Colorado have the fundamental right to a fair and impartial hearing, and the state has confessed this fact. In Colorado, procedural protections are in place to ensure the fairness and impartiality of hearings and appeals. Those procedural protections are public financial disclosures, selection of judges through committee, appointment by the governor, and retention elections through the people.
How is this argument that you are making now different than the argument that was made in Youngs 1, the prior appellate case in this matter?
It's completely different for several reasons.
And what are those reasons?
First of all, in Youngs 1, the attack was made on the Office of Administrative Courts. Second of all, the attack was made as stating that these actions should be brought in the judicial branch. That was the equal protection argument earlier in this case, was that workers' compensation cases have to be brought in the judicial branch or heard in the judicial branch. That is not the argument here at all. The argument here is that, fine, they can be in the executive branch, but you still have to provide equal protection of the laws in the form of public financial disclosures, selection process through committee, appointment by the governor, and public election, impeachment by the legislature, and the Code of Judicial Conduct.
That's the same thing? I mean, you're saying the same thing. You're saying that the ALJs and the panel has to be in the judicial branch, which would make them subject to those requirements mentioned.
I'm not saying that at all. They can be in the executive branch, like the Public Utilities Commission is, which is cited in the brief. The Public Utilities Commission has to file public financial disclosures, just like judges of a court of record. And it has been held that workers' compensation cases can be heard in the judicial branch. I mean, heard in the executive branch, I'm sorry. But if you're going to do that, you have to provide the same procedural protections in the executive branch that apply in the judicial branch. It doesn't mean you lose those protections. Can it be in a different branch of government? Sure. But it cannot violate public financial disclosures, the selection process, the impeachment, or the Code of Judicial Conduct. Now, workers' compensation litigants are accepted out in Colorado and denied these procedural protections. Not only are workers' compensation litigants in Colorado treated differently than any other litigants in Colorado, there is no other workers' compensation hearing and appeal process like Colorado's in the entire nation. Colorado is completely alone in its unconstitutional treatment of workers' compensation litigants. And directly to answer your question, as cited in the brief, other states do have it in the executive branch, but they still have the judges subject to selection and retention and public financial disclosures and these other provisions I've discussed. So the earlier argument was that it had to be in the judicial branch. That argument's taken away. We're not arguing that at all. The argument is, if it's in the executive branch, you still have to provide these procedural protections. Because these fundamental rights are involved, the right to a fair and impartial hearing, the equal protection analysis imposed is one of shifting burdens. Once the different treatment is shown, the burden shifts to the state to show a compelling state interest that supports the difference in procedural protections. The state has failed to even attempt to argue a compelling state interest for workers' compensation litigants. Therefore, it's respectfully requested that you find that the workers' compensation hearing and appeal process violates equal protection of the laws. Respondents in this case incorrectly assumed a rational basis test applied to this matter. Even if that were the case, there is no rational basis supporting the difference in treatment for workers' compensation litigants. The procedural protections regard the fairness and impartiality in the process and have nothing to do with the speed of any particular case. They simply have to do with the quality of the individual who is hearing the case and the fact that that person is subject to the people. Because the hearing and appeal process and workers' compensation violates equal protection laws, the findings below are void. But there are other arguments raised in this case. For instance, the attorney-client privilege was clearly waived below when respondents had their own attorney testify as an expert. Cases from other jurisdictions show this waiver of attorney-client privilege. Respondents cite no case to the contrary. The judge abused her discretion in not allowing a witness to be endorsed by not allowing a witness to be called when that witness was endorsed by respondents. A pre-hearing judge issued an order saying that witness could be called at hearing. Yet the judge arbitrarily at the last minute said, you cannot call this witness. That was an abuse of discretion. Furthermore, the arguments for hearing originally were ripe in this matter. The initial ALJ was correct in not awarding attorney's fees. The attorney fee statute states that the entire application has to not be ripe before fees can be awarded.
Where does it say that?
In 843.211.2d.
Well, if you're gonna make that kind of a statement, and it's not a quote, you need to be pretty careful. It says if it raises issues that are not ripe, and your petition raised issues that were not ripe.
One of three issues was not ripe, that attorney's fees are owed for preparing for such application for hearing. The a previous attorney fee statute has been under the same analysis, and it shows that the language in the workers' compensation fee statute is exactly similar to the prior statute. Therefore, the entire application must not be right. It doesn't say any claim. It doesn't say any issue. It says issues.
It doesn't say only issues either. It says issues, not only issues or just issues.
But it refers to the entire application for hearing as a whole.
It says if the application raises issues, which yours did, it raised issues that were not right.
Well, as judged by the ALJ, the issue was not right. However, I contend the issue was ripe because it was different than any issue that was on appeal. The issue that was on appeal had to do with the division IME. The division IME in the case was at issue because of overcoming the division IME. Therefore, that particular division IME opinion was at issue. The issue in this case was what Pinnacle's duty was to do when that division IME physician was being selected. Patrick Evans didn't know that Pinnacle had paid the company that the division IME was going through more than $2 million over the past several years. Had that financial disclosure been made, then this doctor would have never been selected. So these were completely different arguments. Were they both in essence somewhat on fraud? Yes. We were like, what's going on here? We didn't know what the process was. But they're completely different arguments.
But the time issue was on appeal, and had you prevailed on that, it would have mooted out the other argument, because you can't win twice. You only win once.
But the Workers' Compensation Act specifically allows other issues to go. And the fact is, if we had won a hearing in this matter, it could have mooted the appeal above. So it appears.
But that's not how our court system works, counsel. I mean, you raise an argument, it's on appeal. You raise an argument for relief, and you wait and see how that turns out, because if you win, it moots anything else, any other argument you would make. We don't work the other way around. We don't say, you can bring other actions, you can bring other cases, doesn't matter what's on appeal, and then moot the appeal. We just don't do it that way. That's backwards from how it works.
Well, the workers' compensation statute specifically says you can raise other issues. So I guess that's contrary to the workers' compensation statute.
Well, I guess it depends on how you define an issue. I mean, your issue was a challenge to the dime, as I view it. You challenged the dime on appeal. You challenged it below. Challenged it on appeal. If you had won on that issue, it would have mooted out any other potential claim contention relating to the dime. Would have mooted it out. Isn't that right?
No, because we would have had a different hearing. We would have had it.
But you only get relief once. I mean,
It's a complex procedural process. I know it's workers' comp, and you know you don't want to think of it very seriously, but it's a complex process. And the division IME challenge was very different. And had we obtained relief there, it would have negated the need for an appeal up here, and that would have been withdrawn. And the Workers' Compensation Act specifically allows you to proceed on that other issue. And it was one of only three issues.
But does that mean that you can raise issues that are always raised, issues that are always the subject of an appeal, simply by that language that says other issues? Or issues that have already been adjudicated?
No. I mean, if that particular issue had not been adjudicated, we didn't even know about that issue until after this appeal, the prior appeal was on its way. That issue didn't come up. And had we not done what we did, we would have lost evidence because Pinnacle was destroying emails showing the money trail in between Pinnacle and the division IME physician.
By issue, now you're focusing on the financial interest rather than on the underlying issue that was the subject of the appeal?
Absolutely. It was a completely different argument. The issue on appeal was the propriety of the division IME physician's finding herself. And what became an issue after that appeal went on its way was the financial interest in Pinnacle with the company that did the division IME and what Pinnacle should have disclosed to claimant, this $2 million. We didn't know there was this financial relationship between the two. So they're two different. One's looking at Pinnacle, one's looking at the division IME.
But it seems all you're saying is that on appeal, we win for reason A. We also could win on this issue, the same issue, for reason B. It's a different reason, and that's how you seem to be chopping this up. So as long as you keep coming up with different reasons to win on the same issue, you're saying you can keep bringing different actions. Is that right?
If it's complex, but they're different issues. The Act specifically says you can raise other issues. So it was a completely different issue to focus on Pinnacle's financial relationship with. We didn't even know about that at the hearing that was on the first appeal. That came up afterwards. And once that relationship was disclosed, we had to act on it quickly to get the discovery. And indeed, they admitted in their answers to interrogatories that they were destroying emails more than 14 months old. So had we waited, as you proposed, I would have harmed my client. We would have been prejudiced in raising that issue because the emails were being destroyed. So the Workers' Compensation Act specifically says other issues can be brought, and that's what was done. And it was one of only three issues. The main reason we were going to hearing was Pinnacle wasn't paying an almost $5,000 medical bill, and Pinnacle refused to pay that bill until right before hearing. So they forced us to go to hearing, and we endorsed that as one issue for hearing. Respondents want you to defer to these judges below on all these issues. But these judges could have financial ties with Pinnacle or any insurance company, and we wouldn't know it because we don't have public financial disclosures. There could not be a potential situation more ripe for corruption than Colorado's workers' compensation system. Rich insurance companies against people who are injured at work. And the cases are heard by judges who could have financial ties to the insurance companies. The judges could be hired by a person with financial ties to the insurance companies. There is absolutely no reason to defer to the judges below. You do not need to rule on all the arguments in this case. The hearing and appeal process in workers' compensation violates equal protection of the laws. The decisions below are void. That's the only ruling that needs to be made. I respectfully request that you do so, and I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm Harvey Flewelling, registration number 22605. At council table with me is Alice Hosley, Assistant Attorney General representing the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. We've agreed that I'll do the oral argument today. She is available to answer any questions you may have, however. Initially, with regard to whether the issue of reopening was ripe, as presented to the ALJ, I need to take a position slightly different than my answer brief in that I think I may have conceded that that issue was preserved for appeal. However, as the Industrial Claim Appeals Office order of remand on the attorney fee issue noted, the claimant or Mr. Forsyth did not appeal Judge Cronreich's dismissal of the petition reopening on the grounds of fraud. So the failure of Mr. Forsyth to petition to review or the claimant petition to review ALJ Cronreich's dismissal of the reopening forecloses the argument that that the issue of fraud was a right issue.
But how can you? That wasn't final though. I mean, the panel remanded back.
They remanded only on the attorney fee issue.
But they did remand it back, so we didn't have anything final yet to appeal from the panel. So.
That's correct.
And then this issue was re-raised on the remand, as I recall.
I believe it's our position that the failure to file a petition review basically makes that issue res judicata.
So there was a petition for review after the remand. Okay, and
that's true.
And it was raised there. Is that right? It wasn't the first time.
I believe it was attempted to be raised, or that argument was made. And then the Industrial Court of Appeals Office's order of remand, they did point out, and they did cite case law, the Wallace case versus Industrial Commission, that the ALJ Kermit's order became final because no petition review was filed by the claimant at that point.
It seemed to me that in your answer brief and the ICL's answer brief, you went out of your way to concede that the issue was properly reserved by appellant, and now you're saying that it wasn't. How is that fair to the appellant? He didn't have a chance to reply to your position that you're now taking.
I'm not sure that we definitively conceded that in our brief or in the ICO's brief. We noted that there was no appeal from ALJ Krumreich's order dismissing the petition reopen, and I think my statement was to the extent that Mr. Forsyth did discuss preservation of issues, we weren't objecting to that. I'm not sure if he specifically delved into that issue or not. I don't recall. But regretfully saying, based on my re-review of the record, it's our position that that issue was foreclosed by a failure to appeal the dismissal of the petition to reopen. Essentially, we're relying on our briefs other than that, except for the fact I'd like to go into more on this equal protection argument. The initial question that has to be asked is, has there been disparate treatment of similarly situated individuals in an equal protection or a substantive due process argument, which I think that's what we have here. I don't think the claim has shown, either factually or with any authority, that workers' compensation litigants are similarly situated to all other litigants in the state of Colorado who make state claims based on state law. There are other cases really deciding this, but we have a number of cases that have addressed what similarly situated means in the context of a workers' compensation claim. And most of them, for example, the Eller case, 224P3rd 397, held there's no showing that an employer and employee are similarly situated for purposes of the Division IME scheme. So that case, the Calvert case, 155P3rd 474, also did not find the claimant and respondents similarly situated. So even parties to a workers' compensation claim are not similarly situated. Also, the Safeway versus Industrial Claim Appeals Office case, 186P3rd 103, I think was similar to that. So we have some case law where it's been held that there were no showing that claimants and respondents in the same claim are similarly situated. Here, if there's no showing of this, the initial threshold determination for equal protection, that the workers' comp litigant is similarly situated with all other litigants. It's a totally different system in Colorado for workers' compensation, and it's not a private right that they're trying to enforce.
My understanding is he's simply saying that they're being treated unequally because it's essentially civil litigation where we don't have these requirements of financial disclosure, nomination by the governor, and so on. Why are they not similarly situated if you're talking about other civil litigants seeking compensation versus the claimant here?
The point being made by Mr. Forsyth is that workers' comp litigants are not getting a fair hearing as a result of the statutes that don't allow for disclosures, et cetera. I don't think claimant has shown Mr. Forsyth has shown that he was not entitled to a fair hearing. He was given notice and an opportunity to be heard. But
I think his complaint goes to who the fact finder is and who the judge is, not the ability to cross-examine. He, of course, had that. He had the ability to present evidence. But what he's saying is that I'm entitled to the same type of judge, the same type of neutral fact finder that other civil litigants are entitled to. So we need to focus on that.
Well, I think this sort of analysis has been already addressed by the court in the D Enterprises case and other cases, the Aviato case, that the right to workers' compensation benefits is not a fundamental right, and we're looking at a rational basis for a rational basis standard rather than the strict scrutiny standard. And essentially, the way the workers' comp system is set up is, as the Workers' Comp Act states, the purpose is to provide a quick and efficient method of awarding benefits to claimants at a reasonable cost to employers with no litigation. And essentially, that's the rational basis for the way the system is set up. And I think I can't speak to whether every single state other than Colorado doesn't subject its ALJs to these standards, but I believe that essentially he's arguing the same thing he's argued previously in the D Enterprises case and Aviato, that he's entitled to a judicial department judge versus executive department. And I think these issues have already been decided, and that's the precedent that controls here.
Let me ask about another issue. According to claimant, a pre-hearing order authorized the calling of Mr. Rugsager as a witness, and that opportunity was denied to claimant at the time of the hearing. What was the basis for that?
I think it was explained very well in the ICAO's brief that the attorney that was originally representing the employer passed away. And before he passed away, he had endorsed Mr. Rugsager as the witness to discuss attorney fees. And once he passed away, Mr. Rugsager assumed the position of representing the employer. And he named another attorney in that firm as the witness who would be the expert discussing the reasonableness of those attorney fees. Now, what he got, so part of his pre-hearing, as I understand it, was the addition of Mr. Cairns as the expert witness. The pre-hearing judge also allowed Mr. Cairns to be endorsed as a witness, but also said that Mr. Rugsager could be called as a witness. However, the pre-hearing judge also said this issue could be taken up again with the merits ALJ. So, and that's what happened in this case. Once Mr. Forsyth attempted to call Mr. Rugsager as a witness, there was an objection made based on the Taylor v. Grogan case. And the hearing ALJ allowed Mr. Forsyth to make his argument as to whether the three-prong test from Taylor v. Grogan was met. She determined that he didn't meet those criteria to allow the calling of the employer's attorney. That's basically how the situation unfolded.
It strikes me that if you're in a hearing on the reasonableness of a fee, that it'd be quite ordinary that the attorneys who'd rendered the services would be subject to being called as witnesses.
I don't believe, in this case, Mr. Rugsager, I'm not sure what the precise amount of billing occurred, but he was not the attorney who handled the case when these attorney fees were incurred. There may have been some time billed, I don't recall, but he was not the main attorney. It was Richard Leiby was the original attorney who was on the case, and then Mr. Cairns, I believe, assumed the case from Mr. Leiby once he passed away. So Mr. Wooster was not in a position to testify as to hours that he billed. If he did bill hours, it was an insignificant amount, if I recall the record. So that was what Mr. Cairns was there to discuss and testify to, the reasons of Mr. Leiby's billing and the paralegals and secretaries, whoever else billed, pursuant to the unripe issue. And there was no showing that Mr. Rugstader's testimony would have met the criteria in Taylor v. Grogan, it could have been adverse to the employer, to his client. With regard to Mr. Forsythe's request for the entire file to cross-examine Mr. Cairns, it is true the ALJ ordered that he could not cross-examine him on attorney-client privilege matters, the real issue, I believe, there was discovery. The fact that the ALJs would not allow production or require production of the file as a discovery order because discovery had already expired or it was too late to request additional discovery. And that was the main reason why that file was not ordered to be produced. With regard to the affidavit by Mr. Cairns, the ALJ held that the affidavit was not admissible under Colorado Rule of Evidence 408 because it was an offer of settlement. And in both cases, I believe in the record, page 700 and 781, there was an attached cover sheet to the affidavit basically saying this was a settlement demand. So I think it was well within the ALJ's discretion to hold that offer of settlement was not admissible at the hearing. If there are no further questions, that's all I have. Thank you very much.
In regards to the equal protection issue, the Industrial Claims Appeal Panel has never been challenged. And that is what's challenged in this case. And these issues of public financial disclosures, selection retention, were not raised against the Industrial Claims Appeals Panel in any previous opinion. This is all new stuff. Are there previous opinions on related issues? Yes, separation of powers, a separate argument, was raised in D. Enterprises. And that court, in misciting two United States Supreme Court cases, said, you know, there's no violation of separation of powers. However, in the two United States Supreme Court cases that the appellate court cited, both of them say that workers' compensation matters belong in the judicial branch because they're a private action between private people. Both of them. Furthermore, the only other case that in the country that has regarded separation of powers came out of Louisiana. And in that case, they found it was a civil action. That was a separate argument under Article 6, Section 23 of the Colorado Constitution. In this case, equal protection, fundamental right for a fair and impartial hearing. And we are not getting the procedural protections to guarantee, or as best can be guaranteed, those rights. In regards to his arguments regarding calling the attorney in the Taylor case. This case is completely different than the Taylor case because they listed the attorney on their application for hearing. They were going to have him testify. The attorney who did testify at hearing said he testified in the manner he did because the other attorney told him to do so. So it was clearly relevant to the bills, and we had two bills for the exact same time period in different amounts. So it was clear one of them was false. So the hearing below was crazy, and we believe that gives rise to financial issues. I'm out of time. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both of you for your arguments this morning. And this matter will stand submitted, and opinions will issue in due course. Thank you.